Bob.
Do you want to give your space report at this time, Paul? Go ahead.
Hey, that's fine. I'm back here. Space radio here. Two main topics I just want to cover. Of course, STS-123 is now back after its 16-day mission. Record 16-day mission. But the STS-124 is scheduled to go up. They wanted to go up mid-May, but due to the external tank debacle with these plugs that they have, these 31-pin plugs that penetrate the external tank, and there's delays on that, but you know they know to fix. It worked fine on the last mission. It delayed this mission, delayed previous missions by getting a low fuel cutoff core readings. They've managed to fix this problem through solid connections going through. They actually soldered everything. The external tanks are delaying the mission a little bit. The earliest discovery will take off will be May 31st, and that will have the second part of the Kaibo module that will be going up. Kaibo is built by Japan. It means hope. That's Japan's contribution to the International Space Station. First part went up on the last mission on 123, smaller 14 diameter, maybe 14 foot long cylinder to drop it on. That was installed temporarily on the Harmony node on the space station. The next part is the three part system. The next part will be the big section. I explained last week that they needed to disconnect the extension arm that's normally in the shuttle now, the 50-foot extension, and they're left with the 50-foot boom, but the 50-foot extension is now left on the space station. Because this thing is so big, this thing's like 35 feet long, it's the biggest module yet to go up, again, roughly 14 feet diameter. To be brought up on that mission to be installed. They'll actually install it where the present part one is now, and then they'll relocate part one on top of this module. So it'll be like a two-room complex. Eventually, a third section will be brought up in 09, and that will be an external like patio setup that will contain all the experiments that they want to do that outside the spacecraft, you know, in the vacuum of space. And to do that, instead of having astronauts go out and move things around on this, what you call it, a patio setup, they're going to be using robotic arms. Well, on this mission, they're going to be bringing those arms up. Now, this has nothing to do with the big robot that they brought up last time, DEXA, that they assembled on three spacewalks. This is another set of robotic arms that will be attached as part of the Kaibo system. So there's going to be robotic arms all over this. You know, they've got a Russian robotic arm. They've got the Canada arm, too, that's up there. They've got the, and now they've got DEXA, their big robot with arms that are up there, and it rides around on the mobile transport unit from one end of the station to the other, and they're going to have these arms. They'll be operated by astronauts inside the Kaibo module to move their experiments around on their Part 3 of this whole setup. Let me drop it. So I just want to mention that. That's going to be an 11-day mission. Another mission I know you're very interested in, Dick, is the STS-125, the Hubble service mission, scheduled for August. If these external tanks are, you know, coming in a little late, it might be as late as October, but they will be doing it this year, hopefully, the fifth service mission to the Hubble space station. huddle out of the space telescope. Interesting thought that they're going to install, you know, they're going to put all brand new batteries up there. A lot of them are old. They're older gyros, six sets of gyros. Quite a few have failed. I think they're down to one or two. They're going to be installing a blanket for insulation around the Hubble. And two sets of instruments. I'll explain what they are later. But the interesting part, they're going to attach they call it a soft capture mechanism.
K2RIW, this is Kate to KT1. You copy me, Dick, over.
Yes, I do, Mel. You think it's time to go to the mailbag? It's your choice.
Definitely. Let's give it a try. You know, first of all, something very interesting occurred Wednesday night on 75 meters. Usual discussion about loop antennas, number of them on frequency, and I think it's, getting to a point where one is trying to outdo the other already. And one of the guys that got on, first time he joined us from Kentucky, he lives in a rural section of Kentucky, works for the power light company there, and has a bucket truck at his disposal, and he says lots of wires and poles. And for some reason, he decided that his loop antenna he's going to put up is going to be 5 wavelengths on 160, or approximately 10 wavelengths on 80 meters of 75. Now, the question is, so he says he ran close to 3,000 feet of wire on the loop. The question is, did he really gain anything by increasing the number of wavelengths? In other words, increasing the wavelength of a quad type of configured antenna. Does it make a difference if I, or if I have the opportunity here to add more wire? Is it an advantage that you say you're putting up more wire, or is it just, do you think just happens to be maybe a lot of hype over?
I'm at WS2N to Dick.
Okay, I've got an answer for that one, Mel. Let's see what Paul's got to say. Go right ahead, Paul.
To finish up, another UV camera going up, 30 times more powerful for the Hubble, and another wide field camera 3, they call it, and super powerful. Just, I know you're going to love it, Dick, when the pictures come back. I'll let you go. Back to you. WS2N.
They keep saying that this last repair mission of the Hubble is going to be the very last. And I guess they're saying that they're pretty sure it's going to last until something like 2012. And I think it's the James Webb telescope that's going to be replacing it. What do you know about the status of the James Webb? And are they talking about, first of all, increasing the sensitivity? I know that W shape they get to the many of the photographs they take on the wide field planetary camera is because there wasn't enough money to finish building the whole camera, so to speak. So a portion of it is missing. Is that going to be corrected to your knowledge? And are they proposing that Hubble is going to last at least to 2012 and beyond? And what about the replacement? Over to you, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW in the group.
Okay, sorry, Mel, by the way. Yeah, 2013 is the date I have. And naturally, you know, they go beyond that thing. James Webb, I guess 2016, that's behind it. It's got, you know, their schedule's behind. That's what I'm thinking, 2015, maybe 2016. The wide field camera, it's a new camera, Dick, so, you know, I'm sure they got this thing upgraded. I haven't heard anything about filling in those blank spaces you always see, though. Don't know about it, but my guess is that's all going to be here. All going to be straightened out. Back to you, Dick.
Now, the thing that is most troublesome on wear out are the gyros. Do you think they've done anything to find out what is failing on the gyros, and is there a repair procedure? Is there a way of making the gyros more reliable? Yeah, the batteries are something that, of course, wear out, and they're going to replace all the batteries. And I think you're saying there's going to be a new ultraviolet camera. So probably the all the optics is going to, the detecting circuits are going to be more sensitive, hopefully more reliable, brand new batteries, brand new set of gyros, and I wish there was a way they could make the gyros even more numerous so that they could switch between them when they fail, or find out a way of making them last longer. Any words along those lines, Paul? Go ahead.
Putting six in. I thought they had four. They're putting six new ones in for the gyros. I think it's like anything else, though. They fail, you know, they're spinning parts. As far as I know. I know they make this laser type. I'm not sure which type they have, Dick. You might know. But six brand new ones. Important thing that they're adding is a fine guided sensor. So they're going to be able to direct this thing more accurately than they have in the past. So that's important. And in the beginning of the report, I told you about this grapple type of arrangement they're going to attach to the top of it for future spacecraft, unmanned spacecraft, to attach to it with a rocket on board to blast this thing into the Pacific Ocean. So hopefully they can stretch this thing beyond 2013. My guess they will. But as far as I know, anything I've read, this is it. This is the last one. The fifth and last one. And unless there's money allocated to keep it going, you never know. They wanted to drop it last time, Dick, and here we go. They're going to repair it back to you.
Okay, I think the normal complement of gyros is four. If they're putting in six, that sounds like they've got two more spares. I wish they could put in eight. I wish they had enough switching arrangements that they could put in eight. Back to you, Paul.
Yeah, that rings a bell. I have notes here. I could look at that. I'm sure I could find that. Four is, I was surprised when I saw six. So, yeah, they fail. They've had them fail on the space station. They replaced them up there. These things they don't run forever. It's problematic. They really need them for this type of work. And if they went down to one, it would be okay, but that would be it. They have to have two going. If one should fail as they're approaching with a manned crew, the flight rules in the state that they would not dock with that thing. Suppose it did fail, but as they were approaching it, they have to have two running or more things.
It sort of makes sense to have both azimuth and elevation capability. So if the James Webb is a replacement, and that's not going to be until, I think you said 2014 or 2016, something like that, it sounds like there's a couple of year gap in there in which Hubble might not be there and James Webb is not there yet. And also, isn't James Webb going to be at a much higher altitude? Go ahead.
Yeah. Is somebody trying to come in from IRLP to make a comment?
Yeah, on that one, Dick. Yeah, that's going to be in that one. Is it L2? I forget. Orbital arrangement, balance between the sun, the Earth, and the spacecraft itself. You know, we're going to go around the sun 365 days, so is this thing. So essentially, it's not orbiting Earth. If you want to consider it one orbit per year, I guess that would be okay. Not serviceable.
Now, that's a Lagrange point. The person that's just joining us, you're listening to the technical net that's over the repeater on Long Island. I think that repeater is now being IRLP connected to another repeater. So without giving us too much of a blast of audio, why don't you tell us your call letters, your name, and I think you might have a question or a comment. I'm KQRIW, and my name is Dick.
I think it was HVR. HVR, do you want to make a comment? WDHWW?
This is N2HVR. Do I got the machine?
N2HVR. Yes, you've got the machine.
Good evening, Dick. I was listening to the conversation. I thought there was a telescope called Kepler that was going to go up. I was watching a show on cable called Looking for the Second Earth, and I thought there was going to be a new telescope going up around 2009 called Kepler.
Let's see if Paul knows about that one. Paul, have you heard about Kepler? Paul is our space expert. You got it, Paul.
Yeah, that's the name they gave to the one Planetary Finder telescope mission. And last I heard, about 6 months ago, the funding dried up on that telescope. So, hey, maybe that's making a comeback. I don't know. That's supposed to look for Earth's going around the star systems. We're up to 277. I just read that last week. 277 planets that are around different solar systems. And they're getting close to 300, I think. There's quite a few on the books that they're trying to confirm. Most of them are a couple of times, or maybe four or five times bigger than Earth, mostly bigger than that, hundreds of times. Like Jupiter. Jupiter is 316 times bigger than Earth. Those types of planets are quite numerous. They're looking for Earth-like ones, and the Kepler, or Planetary Finder mission, I think they called it initially some years ago, is supposed to do that. But yeah, again, last time I heard, the funding dried up. Maybe they changed that. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, for people who are interested in space, right now on the newsstands, you might want to get a hold of the April issue of Smithsonian. April issue 2008 of Smithsonian Magazine. On the front cover is an article that I'm about to look for right now. There it is. And the article, I think, is entitled Search for Black Holes or something like that. The Black Hole article, anyhow. It's very well written. 8 solid pages. I'm looking for my write-up on this particular one. I think I found it. Yes. Homing In on Black Holes is the name of the article. So, Smithsonian Magazine, April issue, 2008. Very nicely written article. Lots of photographs, lots of explanation. And what they've discovered, and this is done mostly with the W.T. Keck telescope out in Mauna Kea, Hawaii, with that telescope, which I think they said is 10 meters in diameter, 30 feet in diameter is the mirror. It's a complex mirror made up of a whole bunch of little hexagonal segments all connected together. And by looking at the center of our galaxy, which is near the Sagittarius nebula, they discovered that there is a black hole in the center of our galaxy, which is 10 times the diameter of the Earth, and I think it's 4 million times more massive than the Earth. And there are very massive stars going around that black hole that are moving at 20 million miles per hour, which is 3% of the speed of light. They have reason to believe that the center of every galaxy has a black hole, a massive black hole that holds it all together. And so as they discover more and more about that black hole in the center of our galaxy, it's pretty exciting stuff. Let me drop for a second. And in order to make the Keck telescope at the highest possible resolution, so you can look in close to that black hole and look through all the dust clouds that are in that area with an infrared sensor, they have to use adaptive optics. The adaptive optics need a guide star to know when you've got it tuned correctly. That's the way you take out the shimmer of the atmosphere. If you deposited a quarter in the bottom of your pool on a sunny day and you look at that quarter, it would seem to be moving, shimmering, because of the water motion. Well, our atmosphere is doing the same thing. Our telescope is like that quarter in the bottom of the pool, and it's looking up through that medium, which is continuously in motion. By adaptive optics, you can take out 99% of that adaptive motion. By the adaptive optics, you can take out that motion, and you get a much sharper, higher resolution picture. But you need a guide star to do that. Well, in a lot of places you want to look at space, there is no bright star you can use as a reference for your adaptive optics. So they make their own guide star by using a dye laser, which is an 18-inch diameter laser beam coming out to the side of the telescope, aimed in the direction you're looking at. It excites the molecules that are at 55-mile altitude. I think there are nitrogen molecules, is it, that are at the 55-mile altitude. You excite those. They give you a bright light, so to speak. It's an artificial guide star. Sodium molecules. The sodium molecules are at 55 miles of altitude. The sodium molecules were deposited by the disintegration of meteorites. You've always got meteorites falling on the Earth. They deposit sodium molecules that hang around the 55-mile altitude. This orange-red laser, this gold-orange laser, they call it, excites those sodium molecules, makes an artificial guide star. Astronomers spend their whole life, Astronomers spend their whole life avoiding light pollution. To a degree, you can say the laser they're aiming in space is a kind of light pollution, but it's a very carefully tuned light pollution that only lights up those sodium molecules that are at 55 miles at the very top of the atmosphere. That allows them to align the adaptive optics, which allows them to look in close to the center of our galaxy to look at the blackest object there is, which they see by indirect means. It's a fun article to read, and so I recommend that. If you're interested in astronomy, you'll like that issue of Smithsonian Magazine. I wonder if you heard about that one, Paul. WS2N, K2LIW in the TechNet.
No, I haven't. Very, very good. That's good. I've heard the black hole story, of course, at the center of our galaxy, the other galaxies. They don't think that the globule ones have the, that they might not have the black hole, but definitely the spiral and the barred galaxy. But as far as I haven't heard about the star finding system like that. Now the 36 Mira system, that's part of the delay of the James Webb. They're trying to get that right. James Webb telescope has that. It's kind of like taking the Keck telescope and putting it into space a million miles out and hope all these actuators and laser beams to keep this thing accurate works, without being serviceable. You're not going to take a space shuttle out a million miles out. You can go a couple hundred miles up. I think the top range is 600 miles. It's a long way from a million miles. So it's not serviceable. And to make this all work and unfold correctly, and a lot of work is going to have to be done before they're confident enough to put this thing up into space. And you got to remember, it's going to go up not with the space shuttle either. So, it's not even going to be operable in orbit. It's going to go up, blast out to the million mile area, and then unfurl and become a telescope out there. It's not like they're going to put it into orbit, open it up, and say, okay, we can fix it here. And now we'll send it out to this million mile Lagrange point. Okay, on the star finding system. Interesting, Dick. No, I've never heard of it back then.
Yep. They also say in the article that the Andromeda Galaxy and the Milky Way Galaxy, the one that we're in, and the Andromeda Galaxy, I think, is roughly 2 million light years away, we're on a collision course with them. And when the two get combined, they're going to give that a name, the Milkometa galaxy, a combination of Milky Way and Andromeda, Milkometa. That's a long way off. You've got time. And when two galaxies collide, it's not like two automobiles coming together. There's mostly empty space between all those stars. So everything sort of folds through each other. The gas gets scattered. The stars end up with slightly different orbits. When it comes to the exoplanets, 277 exoplanets discovered so far, the majority of those planets discovered because they're discovered by indirect means. You look for the wobble of the sun because of a planet going around it. So therefore, a large, massive object like a Jupiter-sized planet is what you discover first. People misunderstand that. They think that all of the exoplanets, as they're called, the exosolar planets, are large, and therefore Earth is a rare thing. Well, Earth is a rare thing to discover because it doesn't create as much solar wobble. You wait and see as they build better telescopes. They're going to discover a lot more Earth-like planets. They used to think that planets going around a star is an extremely rare event, once per million stars. They have reason to believe now that at least 10% of the stars have got planets, maybe more. So planets are kind of ordinary. With that many planets around that many stars that we've discovered so far, and a lot more are on the way, it's kind of obvious to a lot of people that some of them are going to contain life and some of them are going to contain fairly advanced life. So a big QSO in the sky is possible someday. The distance is so great, though, that there's a long delay line. There's a bit of a problem there. Now, let's get back to Mel's original question. Stand by. When you build a antenna that's a loop antenna, but instead of making it a quarter wavelength on a side and full wavelength circumference, you make it five wavelengths in either size or circumference, doesn't matter. Any kind of an antenna that you make multiple wavelengths long, if it is a parabolic dish, which means all of those extra wavelengths all properly focus the signal, you end up with a sharper beam. A telescope with a larger diameter mirror has a smaller beam width out of it. It can resolve two stars that are closer together. That's with a parabolic mirror. But if you made the mirror flat, which is sort of what you're doing when you take a loop antenna and make it five times bigger than normal, or maybe 25 times bigger if it's five wavelengths per side, the net result you get out of that, Mel, is that the pattern you used to have becomes more complicated. You develop multiple lobes to the pattern. At certain key angles, massive portions of that antenna come into focus, and a little bit off that angle, portions of the antenna are not in focus. So you end up with a bunch of fingers in space. The good news is that some of those fingers have got higher gain. The bad news is you get some deep nulls in between. So some of your favorite directions are going to have a null, and if one of those nulls falls on London and you want to use your five-wavelength loop to talk to your buddy in London, you might be unhappy. Although maybe with the ionosphere changing state continuously, maybe you get some correction out of that. But the main thing that happens from multiple wavelengths is a little more gain, but a much more complicated pattern with fingers in space. I wonder if the guy you were talking to, who is about to build his antenna, anticipated anything like that. Now, K2KEY, KQLIW on the set net.
Jason says K2KEY. No, it was up. It's all complete. He just came on frequency to tell us about this thing. He was able to get it up quite high also. He had all the facilities there, like I say, working for the Power of Light Company there. In Kentucky, in that rural section of Kentucky, he says, oh, I could put one up even double the size if I wanted to. He says there's an infinite amount of room he had there out in the country of backwoods of Kentucky. But it was putting out one heck of a signal. Everybody gave him reports. He was only running 100 watts, but everybody was giving him phenomenal reports. We had about, I'd say, maybe 10 people on frequency that were scattered all over from the eastern seaboard and out to Texas, Oklahoma, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, Massachusetts. Yeah, we get together quite a group now. And he just happened to, on the frequency, heard us talking about loops, and he told us the whole story, how he managed 3,000 wire. He used everything from poles, he picked up the trees, to this, to that, and had plenty of big insulation. we were just fascinated by hearing this, but it was doing quite well, and according to what he said, since it's been up, he's been working the X galore, and all he gets is a lot of great reports. Now, is it more wire actually gives you more area, maybe more capture area, or both? And receive and transmit, Dick, over.
In the directions where you've got those fingers in space that have higher gain, yes, he's got more area. Gain is area. But in the directions where he has no, he's got less area. So an antenna like that, where the whole thing is not tuned into one simple focal point, like a parabolic dish, it's a little bit similar to what would happen with a rhombic antenna if you made the rhombic a lot longer on the side. Your so-called main lobe would get stronger, and you would develop a finer and finer structure of those side lobes, and those side lobes have got nodes in between them. Now, in the case of a rhombic antenna, your left side of the rhombic and your right side of the rhombic are a mirror image of each other, and if you've chosen the right angles for constructing your rhombic, you do have a main lobe where a lot of that wire all comes into focus. But in the case of this loop, square loop antenna, which is 3,000 feet of wire, it sounds like it's a little bit more than 10 times the normal length of wire for the one that you've got, for instance. You would think he's developing more area. Well, that's simplistic. If you look at the real pattern, and by the modeling program, if he hasn't already done so, he could model the program, he could use a modeling program to predict the pattern of that antenna. And I think it's going to have a bunch of fingers in space and a whole bunch of different angles. And so some of those fingers will be stronger than with your antenna, and some of them are going to be a lot weaker than those that are in between. He's going to come out ahead. In overall performance, he's got a lot more people to talk to. But there are certain angles where he's going to have a little bit of a problem, I think. Back to you, Mel. Drag your feet in case anyone wants to join us. K2LIW on the TechNet.
WB2EAV with the beanbag theory.
Go ahead, Ed. Let's hear the beanbag theory.
An antenna is like a beanbag. The more power you put into it, the bigger the sphere. Then you punch it like a pizza baker with it, turning a dough into an unusual shape. Antenna gain is what picks this beanbag, and it bulges out tremendously on one side. But for every peak one side, there's a null coming out the other side. You never make the volume of the beanbag bigger without upping your transmitter power. What we're describing here is something that looks like a line with quills sticking out in all kinds of odd directions. And unless they're in the direction you want, you have no gain at all. Back to Dick.
And you're sort of right. That's called the 4-pi stair radian phenomenon. It's got lots of names. Gain bandwidth product. The problem really comes about when you're trying to reverse the beanbag theory. I think I told you about the guys that were at the National Radio Astronomy Observatory when I was there in 1995. These are the guys who were radio astronomer-like people, research professors, who wanted to investigate gamma ray burst stars. And the gamma ray burst can get a good size one once every month, but the direction where it comes from is random. In other words, you might get a gamma ray burst at a particular right ascension and a declination, a spatial address, in other words. You get one this month, and the one next month is thoroughly unpredictable. It's the one direction. So these guys were asking me, hey, can you design for me an antenna that's got much higher gain in all directions at once? And of course the answer is no, with a slight exception. You can build a high gain antenna in your favorite direction, build a second high gain antenna a little bit off that direction with a completely separate receiver, and keep multiplying that. So you build this huge sphere where on the surface of the sphere you've got a whole lot of antennas looking into various directions in space, all connected to an individual receiver, and now you have some kind of a computer network looking at all of those receivers to see which one is seeing something. So, in a way, you can build an antenna that's got a lot of gain in a lot of directions at once, but it's not one antenna. It's an antenna system, but it's really a whole lot of individual antennas. But any one antenna will follow Ed's beanbag theory, in my opinion. So, you can squirt it all out in one direction by sacrificing all the other directions. But whenever you integrate all of the power out of any single antenna, you integrate all the power in all directions at once to come up with unity. And you could make the whole back lobe, back hemisphere weak, and make the whole forward hemisphere stronger if you want to. Again, it's called a beamback theory. Out of curiosity, Ed, are you walking with your handy-talkie? It sounds like you're taking your late-night constitutional. WB2EAV, K2LIW, in the tech net.
You got it. I'm late-night constitutional, QSL.
Good exercise. And good discussion we're getting into. How long ago did you come up with your beanbag theory? How many people have you explained it to so far? Have you had any difficulty getting people to believe it? Because I think you're right on target. Over to you, Ed.
15 or 20 years ago, I told it maybe a dozen times, and the general catched in the hate.
Now, there's variations of that beanbag theory. It's also called the bowl of jello theory. And I've heard some people, some antenna enthusiasts, use that one. You punch someplace in the bowl of jello, and it comes squirting out in some other direction. So, every antenna, every single antenna that doesn't have a whole bunch of little active amplifiers buried into it, when you integrate all of the power coming out of it, when you're transmitting, in all possible directions in space, you will come up with unity. So, the word gain of an antenna is really gain with reference to isotropic. Well, what is isotropic? That's an antenna that squirts energy in all directions. That's a completely spherical beanbag. That's one way of looking at it. Another way of looking at an isotropic antenna, one that works in all directions at once, it's a beautiful theoretical model of the lowest possible gain antenna that has no lossy elements in it. There's no resistors, there's no attenuators. So if you build a real antenna that is lossless, and if its impedance matched, you cannot get the gain any lower than isotropic. That's the absolute bottom, that's the floor, that's the basement of the antenna world. It's a beautiful reference. Every real lossless antenna must have more gain than an isotropic in some direction. But the only way it can have more gain in some direction is that it has less gain in some other direction. All the power integrated across all those angles has to be unity. So, when we talk about an amplifier, I can put in 1 milliwatt and I can get a watt out of an amplifier. That's 1,000 times more power coming out than I put in. We call that gain. That's 1,000 to 1 gain in decibels of 30 dB. However, that gain comes at a price. Let me drop. You supply plus or minus 15 volts, so to speak, to that amplifier to give it the ability to do that. That's where the gain is coming from, the active amplifying stages with an external source of power. In the case of an antenna, almost all reasonable conventional antennas, there is no B plus input connector. There's no gain inside real. So to come up with the word gain for an antenna is with reference to something you consider a standard. And the isotropic antenna or the dipole antenna are two very popular standards. Another standard is a 15.5 dB gain horn antenna. When it comes to microwave frequencies, there's a popular size horn antenna with around 15.5 dB of gain that everyone uses as the standard or the reference. So gain of an antenna is with reference to something else you know about. Mathematically, isotropic makes a nice reference. In reality, it's not a nice reference because no one's ever built an isotropic antenna. Well, you can come close with certain kinds of antennas, certain combinations of radiators. An H-field radiator and an E-field radiator properly combined can come close. But The only real very low gain antenna we all have reference to is a dipole. However, when you're setting up your antenna range, although the dipole is a nice thing to refer things to, my Yagi has got 10 dB of more gain compared to a simple dipole. It's a nice reference way of talking about it. The problem is, if you really put a dipole on your antenna range, it is a very persnickety antenna. It radiates in all directions at once. It lights up everything. If there's any extraneous object anywhere on your antenna range, a dipole is going to light it up. It's going to give you a multipath signal that's going to contaminate your measurement. If you're measuring an antenna with very low gain, that's not so bad. If you're measuring a parabolic dish that's got 30 decibels of gain in one particular direction, and you want to compare it to a dipole, which has got 2 dB of gain in a whole lot of direction, and it's lighting up a whole lot of extraneous stuff on your antenna range, it's kind of hard to make a good, accurate measurement under those conditions. Now, I wonder if an antenna range for making accurate antenna measurements has ever been set up on Dover Street. I'm gonna talk to that scientist on Dover Street and find out if he's ever set up an antenna range. K2KEY, K2RIW in the tech deck.
Yeah, Roger, this is K2KEY. Well, you know, I have to, in a way, I keep somewhat of a low profile, Dick. So I don't try to, you know, attract very much attention. Lucky I get away with that tower I got in the yard here. I had enough problems getting service for it. And the loop antenna, I have no problem with neighbors on either side. And I got to be careful of shrubbery. I got to be careful of trees, you know, cutting or anything. So I can't do a heck of a lot of modification. I'm happy I'm able to take this thing around. Because, you know, it has to go up front part of the loop, you know, where it goes across the backyard, the two poles, and hits up front. And one support is a tree limb, and the other support is a light. It's a street light. So that was the only way I could get it supported in front. Now, as far as experiments, you know, I did a few experiments with it, but the front question is, I could actually put up some more wiring. I could go maybe another, I guess, so if I spread it out over there, I guess I could put another, maybe another 35, 40, 45 feet of wire, but I would assume that it wouldn't help them. The only thing I was thinking of, the resistance of the loop. I estimated the resistance to be maybe as high as 5,000 ohms on these loops. Maybe that is one of the reasons that they work better with 600 ohm open wire feeders. That most everybody said they've never had any success feeding it with coax. Is my assumption fairly right that do you know of a way, a simple way that you actually can measure the resistance of a loop antenna, Dick, over?
I was doing that exact measurement Friday afternoon at around 6 o'clock at one of the salt mines I work at. And you're speaking of radiation resistance here, Mel. When it comes to your loop of wire that's roughly 265 feet long, you could put an ohm meter across it, and you're going to measure 1, 2, 3 ohms, something like that, of real resistance of the wire. Because the skin effect at 80 meters and 40 meters, the real resistance of the wire is going to be a few times higher than that measurement. But when the wire is being fed as a full wavelength loop antenna, the radiation resistance, the apparent resistive component of the impedance of the antenna at the end of your transmission line sees, might very well be 5,000 ohms. Many antennas that have either a half wave fed at the end or a full wave fed at the center, full wave fed at the center, a full wave dipole fed at the center, yes, would be thousands of ohms. And it's not very difficult to measure that, Mel. Your transmission line, and by the way, because it is something like 5,000 ohms, with 600 ohm transmission line, I'm going to do that calculation while we're talking, you have a standing wave ratio that is a somewhat controlled number. Let's assume that your antenna is 5,000 ohms, 5, I get the right key right here, 5 exponential 3, that's your impedance. If you set it with 600 ohm line, you would have a standing wave ratio of around 8.3. 8.3 standing wave ratio on 600 ohm open wire line probably is giving you an extra couple of tenths of dB of loss. Not much. However, if that 600 ohm line, enter, was being fed with 50 ohm coax, the standing wave ratio would be 12 to 1. Not only does coax cable have higher loss than open wire line, but the combination of higher loss of the transmission line used correctly with a 50 ohm load, combined with using it with a 12 to 1 standing wave ratio, really means the energy going up your transmission line, 90 some odd percent of it is reflecting back on the first bounce. By way of your antenna tuner, you're making all of those bounces on the transmission line fall in phase so that the power eventually gets radiated, but that power is being bounced back and forth, I'm going to make a guess, 12 times before it finally gets radiated. So you're going through the insertion loss of the cable a whole lot of times. Therefore, coax cable on that full wave loop.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Therefore, that full wave loop of wire fed with 50 ohm line is going to have a lot more loss. So 600 ohm line is the right way to go. Now, even though you're using 600 ohm line, you could do what is normally done with a vector network analyzer. Let me describe that to you. In a real world with a vector network analyzer, almost never do you take your circuit under test and connect it right at the front panel, right on that connector coming out of the front panel, which in many cases is a type N connector or an AP7 precision connector, whatever. Almost nobody connects the circuit right at the front panel. You almost always, for convenience reasons, can connect it after some length of coax cable. In fact, the network analyzers that I most often use is used with something like 6 feet of cable, and at 1,000 megacycles, 6 feet of cable is around 7 or 8 wavelengths if you include the velocity factor. So there's quite a few wavelengths of cable between the front panel and my circuit under test. But when you do the calibrating procedure, you're doing two things. Number one, you're finding out how much loss there is in the cable, because you're going to grind that back out before you display on the screen what it thinks is the impedance of your circuit. It has to know the loss of the cable, because you're not trying to plot the loss of the cable, you're trying to plot the impedance of your circuit. So the calibration procedure has to find out the loss of the cable. Second of all, the cable at your favorite set of frequencies you want to test to that has a certain phase length. It's a certain number of wavelengths long. So therefore, if it was an odd number of quarter wavelengths, for instance, a low impedance of your circuit would on the far end at the front panel of the network analyzer look like a high impedance. A 25 ohm resistor on the end of a 50 ohm cable that is a quarter wavelength long at the other end of the cable, at the shack end, so to speak, which is the front panel of the network analyzer, it'll look like 100 ohms. So you put 25 ohms on your 50 ohm cable and the front panel is going to see 100 ohms. Well, if the front panel, if the whole network analyzer was properly calibrated so that it knew your piece of cable is a quarter wavelength long, it knows how to readjust what it plots, and it'll put a 25 ohm dot on the Smith chart front panel screen. It'll take out your length of cable. So we call that normalizing. We call it referencing. So you can teach the network analyzer how to reference the end of your cable by teaching it how long the cable is in degrees of phase length at all of your frequencies and what is the insertion loss. Let me drop. So every good network analyzer, when you go through the CAL procedure, what you're really doing is you're putting a 50 ohm resistor at the far end. That teaches it whether or not there's a disconnection, a error in the connector an error in the cable because there's a pinch somewhere. It sweeps across all the frequencies while you've got a good termination on there. That's step number one. Step number two, it sweeps across all those frequencies with a short circuit at the far end. There's something called a calibrated short circuit that you use with a network analyzer. And it is a short circuit. It looks like a connector. Inside of it is a short circuit with a known length of transmission line inside of that device. And there's another device you've got called an open circuit with a known length of line inside of it to the real open circuit. So you do the CAL procedure by plugging in the 50 ohm termination. You press the button and say, okay, memorize all that. That's a good termination. Then you put on the short circuit. You press the right button where it says, that's short circuit. Memorize the performance with a short circuit on there. Then you put the open circuit on. You press on the button. You tell it, memorize all the performance with the open circuit. Now, at every frequency, your network analyzer, with its memory, and with its built-in very fancy program called a 12-point correction procedure, it knows at every one of those frequencies what a short looks like, what an open looks like, and what a termination looks like, a perfect 50-ohm termination. With all of that in its memory, you then can connect anything you want at the far end of that particular piece of cable. Don't change the cable. Don't put another adapter on the end. Don't do anything to the setup. But now you put all of your circuits under test at the far end of that cable, and it accurately plots them on that Smith chart or on that XY plot, whichever way you want to display the data. It'll tell you exactly what your circuit is at every frequency that you've done the calibration for. So since the network analyzer is just a computer generator, it's just a computer program connected to a signal generator and a receiver. That's all it really is. It's a phase-sensitive, amplitude-sensitive receiver with a known synthesized signal generator and a computer program. So it measures what goes out, what comes back, amplitude and phase, plugs it into the computer program, and out comes the answer. Now, you're not trying to sweep it at a whole lot of frequencies. You probably care most about what happens at 3750, if that's one of your favorite frequencies. So you could put a short circuit at the end of your 600 ohm transmission line, an open circuit, and a 600 ohm termination, measure what impedance you appear to see inside the shack, at the shack end of your 600 ohm transmission line. With that data in hand, you'll know exactly what impedance that antenna is presenting.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
With that data in hand, Mel, you'll know exactly what impedance is being presented by your antenna to the far end of your transmission line. I think you see the relationship here between you can construct right on Dover Street the poor man's equivalent of a network analyzer. I didn't say it's easy. It's going to take some study. Nowhere near as bad a study as what you did when it comes to building a lattice filter network out of quartz crystals. This is a much easier project. And if you've got one of those AEA devices, that'll make it even easier. So nowadays, people do this every day, find out what the impedance is at the far end of the cable. K2KEY, I wonder if you realize that you can do this. K2LIW in the deck net.
Until we go with a question, Dick.
Yeah, hold on, Rich. Mel first.
Okay, this is K2KEY. A very interesting concept. I'm visualizing already what you're talking about and what to do. I was going to ask, I got the AEA analyzer, of course, I got the, you know, a few of them, the HF, VHF one, I've got the TDR, and I've got the RF amplifiers, which I did the experiment. I remember calling to put them in the line when it actually was taking place. Of course, the best analyzer.